The Athletic.
If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, now's the time with our best offer ever. Sign up today and you'll pay just £1 a month for the next 6 months, giving you unrivaled insight and analysis of everything Euro 2020 and taking you well into the new Premier League season too. The Athletic is the only place you can read pieces by award-winning writers like Michael Cox, Rafa Honigstein, Amy Lawrence and Daniel Taylor. And when you subscribe, you'll also get ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts from across its audio network. Head to theathletic.com/totally and become a subscriber today for £6 until the end of the year. That's theathletic.com/totally.
Good afternoon, passengers. This is a pre-boarding announcement for flight 89. Please have your boarding pass and identification ready.
If you're an England fan, Grinch, take a look around and drink it in.
Shaw,
across for Sterling. Oh,
Grinch,
pass on, Kane. Where you are, who you're with, because this,
unbelievable,
is one of those landmark football moments that don't come around too often.
Indeed, 2-0 over Germany. Southgate adopts traditional Italian tactics by having a striker who's immobile, but with Sterling in the pocket and with a walking Kane, he turns the nation on again. Now, can he give his team a semi? Ukraine are the opponents next Saturday in Rome, or what's left of them. We look back on their grueling clash with Sweden. Plus, we hear from Julien Laurent on what went wrong for the French. We say, here's to you, Mrs. Rabiot, and we get more from the vaults in On This Day at the Euros. It's totally at the Euros in association with Paddy Power. Yep, they sang it. It's Wednesday the 30th of June for you, listener, the day after England shuffled their way past Germany into history in the quarterfinal in Rome. And we are here the evening before, still Tuesday night for us, with Adam Crafton. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Hello. With Raphael Honigstein, who's just back from Wembley.
Hello, James.
And with Daniel Story, whose knees have gone all trembly. Daniel.
Exactly right, James. Good evening.
Right. Good evening to you. Well, it was a day that I think for England fans was pretty special, Tuesday. Others may have felt that after the mad speedball-fueled antics of Monday, this was more of a kind of Sunday afternoon cup of tea set of fixtures, pace-wise. Anyway, England 2-0 winners over Germany. Ukraine then later that evening, after extra time, or right at the end of extra time, getting the second goal in a 2-1 victory over Sweden that puts them into a quarter-final clash with England next Saturday in Rome. The other quarterfinals being earlier on Saturday, it'll be Czech Republic against Denmark, and on the Friday in St. Petersburg, Switzerland against Spain, and in Munich, Belgium against Italy. Crikey. It's quite an interesting picture, isn't it? One of Denmark, Czech Republic, England and Ukraine is going to be in the final. Can't argue with that, can you?
Interesting, yes.
Also, as Mohamed Butt points out, with Germany going home, there are now more Brighton players at Euro 2020 than there are Real Madrid players. Incredible.
Also true, yeah. Good.
Mm. All right, then. Well, look, we're all saving up our really top material for our match analysis, so let's straight away get to Wembley for England 2 and Germany 0.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
For Shaw, and now Grealish. Grealish in!
A 2-0 victory for England in a game that, well, to my mind, was kind of pretty poor for 70 minutes against a pretty poor Germany. Daniel, you called it, though, the most satisfying victory you could remember in your lifetime.
Yeah, for England, not because the game was filled with quality, but because it had a psychological element to it that is inevitable, not just because of unnecessary nostalgia, but because England had never won a knockout match in 90 minutes at the European Championship before. And this one came laced with the type of pitfalls that England teams normally either fall into or trip themselves up into. And they didn't do that. I thought they were pretty nervous early on. I thought they grew into the game as if they seemed to realise that there wasn't any need to fear this Germany team. A Germany team that did create a couple of good chances, it should be said, or were given a couple of good chances in one case. But they grew into that game. And, you know, we'll talk about Gareth Southgate, I'm sure, in a little while. But everything that he did in the game pretty much came off, and not all of it was expected. So, you know, he left on two central midfielders who had bookings. He left on Harry Kane. He brought on Grealish at what turned out to be pretty much the perfect time. And, yeah, it all does seem to be coming up roses for Southgate, whether by luck or judgment or a bit of both.
Adam, your reaction was, it's a good outcome for everyone. Southgate fundamentalists get to call it a masterclass. Grealish fanboys get to say he decided the game and must start. Everyone wins. What was your actual take on it, though, in between all of that?
I was just saying to someone this evening, you know, sort of comparing the text messages that I was sending and receiving at around 70 minutes compared to 95 minutes. And you wouldn't think it was the same person sending those messages. I'm definitely one of those people that thought, you know, I thought that the approach was a little bit too conservative. I think we got a little bit lucky in that, you know, Jordan Pickford made a great save. Muller missed a great chance. I don't necessarily think England controlled it necessarily as well as it will probably be remembered. I think Germany, you know, were also really poor on the day. But, you know, it's England in the quarterfinals and all nuance, therefore, goes out of the window. And you sound very, very curmudgeonly if you criticise England in these conditions. I think what was impressive about England was that they did, you know, it's still quite a young team. I know they were helped by, you know, obviously Maguire coming back in, who's got more experience. But I think they dealt with the size of the occasion quite well. They didn't seem to become overawed, and they didn't panic. I think that was one of the bigger things as well. As that game drifted in the second half, and, you know, by 70 minutes, you were thinking, I've seen this second half before, and it drifts and it drifts. And then, you know, it either goes into extra time and penalties and you lose it, or Germany just come up with the goal. And they found that little bit of inspiration, and his subs worked out. And as Daniel says, you know, if Declan Rice picks up a second yellow card, then you're saying, why has he left him on for that long? So yeah, he certainly got away with certain things, but, you know, there was also a level of organisation that should be admired, even if, you know, the balance maybe isn't quite there yet from an attacking point of view.
I think probably everyone was delighted above all for Gareth Southgate, one of the nicest guys in football. Rafa, you were actually there. What did you make of the afternoon? First of all, the atmosphere, and did you get much reaction to your presence from people on the way to the ground and that kind of thing?
No, none whatsoever.
No.
I mean, usually they confuse me with Guillaume Balague, but now that he's off air for a while, it's not even that. No, got no reaction. But then, you know, it's difficult with the mask and everything. So,
right.
Otherwise, I'm sure they would have been queuing up for autographs and selfies. The atmosphere was great. I mean, the atmosphere was great. You could sense just that slightest amount of trepidation and anxiety, especially when Germany kept the ball really well in the first 15 minutes. And it took the England team a long time to figure out that Germany were playing with three men in midfield in possession, with Havertz actually not playing up front, but playing as a midfielder. But once they wised up to that, then there was very little from Germany. It was difficult to understand or to evaluate who was controlling who, because both teams were so limited in their ambition. They could both claim that their game plan was sort of working. And it was very much the Spider-Man meme as a football game. I didn't think Germany played particularly badly. It was probably one of their better performances in recent years. That in itself is perhaps quite indicative of where Germany are at the moment. They could have won the game. It was pretty even. They could have easily drawn it into going into extra time, and then who knows. But ultimately, the team won that had a game plan and made it stick. Germany had an idea. It wasn't fully formed. It was sort of a compromise, as most of the things that Löw has done. Playing with the ball, but then playing without it. Trying to be dominant, but not too much. Not taking risks. Keeping people back. This halfway house attitude basically cost Germany, maybe not on the night itself, but over the whole tournament. And it was interesting with Gareth Southgate, because I think, as Adam said, on minute 70,
I think the knives were out. I mean, this was an England manager not taking any risks, leaving most of his best players or many of his best players on the bench, devising a formation that was even more negative than the system he'd played before, and seemed to be taking a big risk by not taking much risk. But of course, when it works out, it's beautiful. And results football that brings results has a special kind of magic to it. But if it doesn't, then you can look very, very undercooked and exposed. And I think the jury is still out on this England. I can understand why Germany, as a symbol maybe, or you know, as a bogey team, posed a special kind of challenge. But it was the last 16, and you now have to continue with this system to see it through. And I wonder what the reaction would be if it doesn't quite then work out. If you get beaten in a semi-final or get beaten in the final, will people still consider it worth it? A journey for all the results? Or will they perhaps think that this England was somehow limited in its ambition? I think it's still going to be the decisive question for England and this tournament.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, my biggest thing as that game went on was just thinking, you know, if Germany get that first goal, imagine the regrets you're going to have. You know, when you look over at that bench and you see the players who haven't even got onto the pitch during that game. And I was just thinking, God, like, imagine being Gareth Southgate and in 20 minutes, when this game's over, you're always going to look back and think, this wasn't a great German team. And we had them at Wembley and we just let the occasion pass us by. And obviously it's turned out completely the opposite. History will judge it as the night of great vindication. That's the way that knockout football works, and it's fantastic. But I do think you're right. It's really interesting to see how Southgate uses the momentum and energy that comes from this result, because you now have games, well, hopefully games plural, against Ukraine and then Denmark or Czech Republic, where, you know, I don't think England can go to cancel out, certainly not Ukraine. They maybe would do against Denmark, but again, probably not Czech Republic. I think, you know, you probably play with a four-man defence in those games and introduce one more attacking player into it. They have to play, I think, with more creativity. And we've seen, you know, we saw in the group stages that they do struggle to break teams down when they're allowed the ball. But it's all a question now of, can they use that momentum, and does that momentum kickstart them? I mean, there was a big difference, I felt, in England's confidence between 0-0 and 1-0. You know, and by the last 5 to 7 minutes, it felt like, you know, England were almost a little bit rampant in certain ways. So there's a confidence that comes from it, but, you know, I just hope they can channel that to play a little bit more memorably on the ball.
Right. I mean, it was a very frustrating game for the bulk of it, but by the end, there were certainly some massive positives that England fans can celebrate, not least Sterling, the fellow with the tattoo of a boy looking up at Wembley, scoring again at Wembley, just down the road from his old place. Also, Luke Shaw's performance. Pickford, you've previously mentioned, continuing his excellent tournament with the save on Timo Werner early on, but especially that remarkable athletic stop on Kai Havertz's shot. What stood out for you, Daniel? Also, Jack Grealish, was it a coincidence that everything happened after he came on the field?
No, but the one thing I think of, I'm trying not to be too kind of happy-clappy about Southgate, because it is just a quarter-final, but well, he's not a manager who has these kind of, you know, he's not outwardly passionate. You struggle to get inspired by him in terms of his demeanour, but he does clearly have a very firm kind of conviction and faith in what he believes is the right way to do it. Because let's not escape the fact there's been a huge tide of negativity against England's own negativity. And some of that is completely understandable given the opposition we're playing, particularly the Scotland result and performance. And some of it he will consider as unfair because England have not conceded a goal in the tournament yet, and they're the only team not to do so. But the big calls he had, in hindsight, he's got right. You know, 3 months ago, people were talking about Nick Pope instead of Jordan Pickford, and Pickford wasn't good enough to be England number one. He was criticised because there was a reticence to leave Harry Maguire out, even though his injury looked pretty serious, and there was a doubt whether he'd be fully fit within the tournament. Raheem Sterling's continually been dogged by this, should he start for England. Harry Kane had a rotten group stage, and there was, I think, understandably, a kind of a surprise that Dominic Calvert-Lewin wasn't on the bench today. And yet, as I say, maybe it's a combination of luck and judgment, but when you're winning games, you probably deserve that to be considered as judgment more than luck. And everything has pretty much come off, albeit I accept not in a kind of clanging, banging, all bells or whistles football that we would love England to play. But then, I don't know, England don't really have the history of success to be able to demand that, I don't think. We're not at that stage. Southgate's point is that you cannot skip steps on the way to becoming a successful international team, and he believes this is the most realistic way for it to happen. And so far, I don't think we can doubt that too much. Albeit, as Rafa and Adam completely rightly say, if England don't win their quarterfinal, suddenly it's Southgate out again. Let's make no bones about that, because that's how this works.
I think as well, I mean, you know, there's not only the judgment side of it, but there was also this emotional tidal wave by the end of that game. And when you saw Southgate, you know, he gave this interview to the BBC probably within 15 minutes of the match finishing, where he talks about looking up at David Seaman in the stands and almost feeling that he's carried this guilt for years towards his the teammates that, you know, he maybe feels that he let down by missing a penalty at Euro 96.
You know, I can't, for the teammates that played with me, I can't change that. So that's always going to hurt. But what's lovely is that we've given people another day to remember. And now we've got to go and do it in Rome.
That narrative of redemption is incredibly endearing and charming. And, you know, I was watching that with a little bit of a wobbly lip, listening to him and just feeling absolutely terrible for the text messages that I'd sent about 25 minutes before. So, I think that was an extraordinary interview just within 15 minutes of the game finishing, that, you know, that went out to probably 15 to 18 million people. And I think, you know, there is a real connection when Southgate wins that the country has with him, and that will carry the team a long way now.
No, he's hugely likeable. Rafa, do you think in 25 years' time, when Thomas Müller is the Mannschaft's manager, he'll be performing a similar interview about his guilt feelings about that chance that he squandered at the end? Or indeed, that astonishing error which almost put Sterling and then Kane through early on in the game, in the first half?
Yeah, it's not possible that these things might come to pass. I think Müller is possibly a manager in the making. I have a slightly different take on that miss. Of course, he should have scored. There's no debating. But it perhaps wasn't a complete coincidence, or there is perhaps an explanation for it. The explanation, it might sound a bit trite, but it feeds into, I think, the wider problem for this Germany team. In my view, part of the reason why Müller might have missed is because he just doesn't get into these type of situations regularly. You don't see Müller running towards goals with 40 meters to go on a counter-attack. It just doesn't happen. I've never seen him in almost 400 games at Bayern being the guy who runs from the counter-attack towards goal and then shoots. I think he almost wasn't ready for this type of situation. It's not his game. And I think that's Germany's problem all along. They were playing a game that was never really fully their game. They were trying to mitigate problems, which then created other problems. You had arguably the best and most important player out of position throughout the tournament in Joshua Kimmich. All these tiny issues, which taken by themselves would probably not quite be enough to tilt the scales. But if you add too many of them on top of each other and then have the vagaries of international football on top of it, knockout situations where you need to take your chances, it was just probably too much for this team to deal with. And in the end, it's perhaps not a coincidence that this Germany team, while having played reasonably well, just can't quite get it done. Not just in this game, but if you look at the last two tournaments, they've had four games without scoring a goal and seven games without a clean sheet and just two wins in between them. So that is not the sign of a team functioning well. And that's the reason why I had very low expectations, no pun intended. And that's why I'm almost, I don't want to say pleasantly surprised, but I'm not even particularly upset, because you almost feared it could be much, much worse. Germany weren't a disgrace at the Euros. They just weren't particularly good.
Okay. One other thing on England, unless there are other things you want to discuss, but Harry Kane, what's the position now? He scored, so everything's okay, or the kind of previous 80 minutes suggests that there is a fundamental issue there with putting all your eggs in his basket.
I was so close to writing with 20 minutes to go, England doing really well with 10 men to hold out against Germany. And then I thought better of it. I mean, he was really a complete non-entity, but it doesn't matter because scoring a goal is the most important thing you can do. And he was there when it mattered right at the end. So no one will remember it.
But if you're Gareth Southgate and you're thinking about the next game, do you think, well, that's fine, I can just continue this way or what?
Yeah, he will start every game for which he is fit for England. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And he says that fitness is not an issue. It's just, you know, it's not been clicking and he's not seen much of the ball. I did think he looked, as Adam said about the England team in general, as soon as England went 1-0 up, suddenly you seem to see him, maybe because England was sitting so deep, you seem to see him dropping back and he was winning the ball and picking it up and trying to link play as if, I don't know, as if maybe he needed the confidence of England scoring to go again. But he was a non-entity in the game. But that won't make a difference to Southgate's selection. He reasons, and not unreasonably, that if you leave Kane on the pitch long enough, he will click long enough. He's got the instincts enough that even if he's not on form, he will create a chance. And let's face it, he should have scored against the Czech Republic. He had a great chance. He should have scored the first goal against Germany, and he did score the second. And Southgate will consider that even for a player that is pretty lost, that will be good enough to start against Ukraine, I'm sure.
It is baffling, though. I mean, we talk about a player who has just not had a period like this, really, since he, you know, really broke through at Spurs. There hasn't been... He's been so robotic, like a machine. You know, the idea of him malfunctioning just when you need him most and when other players around him are actually... You know, Sterling's playing really well. I thought Saka was good again, particularly first half, but then faded. Obviously, Grealish is doing well when he comes in. It's really mystifying. I don't think there's anything in the sort of suggestions that he's distracted by transfers and stuff like that. I just don't think he's playing well, and might be, you know, I still think he looks like he's carrying a knock of some sorts. I mean, the other really bright spot for England was Luke Shaw, who would get, you know, again, one of those players who for the first hour you're looking at him and thinking, what's he waiting for? Was he waiting? You know, is he going to go up that space down the left side? Can he get a bit more further forward? And then all of a sudden, the last 25 minutes, he came alive and played faster and with more intensity. And when he plays like that, with speed in his game, he's, you know, he really is a brilliant player. And because I probably again spent the first hour thinking maybe Chilwell would come in for the next game, but you know, he's absolutely nailed that place down now. And I'm pleased for him as well, because you know, with injuries and different managers and form at different times, there's been a lot of question marks against him, you know, to the extent that, you know, I think his previous Manchester United contract went to within a year of expiring, and no, you know, United fans weren't really talking about, oh, we really need to tie Luke Shaw down for another 5 years. You know, the club did it, and he's absolutely proving value for it now. So delighted for him. And also Calvin Phillips, again, I thought was really good.
I think in terms of Ukraine, there's a pretty obvious switch, which is moved to back to a 4-3-3 with Mason Mount coming in for Kieran Trippier to be in the three-man midfield, and then bringing Grealish for Saka, who I thought started really well. But I just think the difference when Grealish came on now, particularly in Kane, means that shifting Sterling over to the right probably makes sense, and playing Walker and Sterling down that right-hand side with Mount in midfield, it just feels that I think this was a one-game experiment or a one-game necessity with the back three rather than a permanent shift for this tournament.
Raf, just on Germany, who do you see sort of Flick building his team around? Which of, you know, there's obviously a lot of really talented young players, particularly in the forward positions. Is who do you get the sense that he will build around?
It's not easy to answer. I mean, I think Joshua Kimmich and Leon Goretzka will be the midfield duo. I think Toni Kroos might have a hard time holding on to his place, although he was one of Germany's better performers at these Euros, and I quite liked what he did against England. The big question for Flick is, can he play that Bayern system with high pressing, high line, and no Lewandowski with this Germany team? Or does he have to opt for a slower build-up to make more of Kai Havertz. I mean, Kai Havertz can play on the break, but you want them on the ball a lot more. You want more of a rhythm. And if you still want Thomas Müller to stay, also you need to be much closer to the opposition box. You can't really start so deep. It's not his game. So I think he's got a lot of interesting questions to answer, because you cannot simply take the Bayern blueprint and make Germany play that way. There's too many key parts missing. And of course, the age structure of the team also doesn't work in his favour. There's not going to be a Boateng around. And can Gnabry play that way throughout his time? Or is it just too tiring if you play like that in the national team and for Bayern with this high pressing? It's going to be really interesting. But the one thing I think we do know is that Goretzka and Kimmich will run the show in the middle. And that then will create a knock-on effect that Toni Kroos might be impacted, and Ilkay Gündoğan as well.
Well, Germany, no strangers to building title-winning machines from the ruins of previous sides, as, of course, you documented in your excellent Das Reboot, Rafa. Now, next up on the Totally Football Show at the Euros, we'll head over to Glasgow to check in on Ukraine, victorious later on Tuesday night in their last 16 match against Sweden.
The Euros are here, and we'd better make the most of them, because they only come around every 4-5 years. So if your bookie isn't making you feel special, then maybe it's time to find a new one. Yep, not so much carpe diem as carpadium. If the grass is greener on the other side, come and play on it. If your bookie's not giving you the best rewards, switch. And if one leg of your 4+-fold bet builder lets you down, get money back as a free bet on all games this Euros. Paddy Power. Pretty much only, max free bet £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. Minimum odds 1 to 5 on exclusive T's and C's apply. 18+. BetGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
We're sponsored for this episode of the Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to the Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Singing in the Ukraine after Andriy Shevchenko's side, having placed third in their group behind Netherlands and Austria, managed to get past Sweden in extra time. Crikey. Have a listen to how much fun this was with Ukrainian commentators.
Нам пити немає часу, але я хотів би так. Парафану навіс на довбак і забиває, вийшовши на заміну збірна України через свого гравця.
Artin Dovbyk with the winner there. Daniel, you were all over this game after the thrills of Wembley. They've taken the lead in some style, haven't they, Ukraine?
Yeah, a beautiful ball from Andrei Yarmolenko. Outside of his foot is a very Yarmolenko-like. load of whip on it across the goal, and Zinchenko got his knee above the ball enough that he could impact a huge amount of power, which kind of burst Robin Olsen's glove. And yeah, 1-0 Ukraine. It was a game that inevitably I watched with England focused eyes, and it was an incredibly draining 120 minutes, and there were bookings and injuries and stoppages galore. If England fans could have drawn or thought up a better last 16 tie for who we would face in the quarterfinals, this would have been it. Yarmolenko went off injured. Buskan had a horrible leg injury, it looked like. I suspect he'll be out. So yeah, Ukraine are dogged, and I thought they looked really good against the Netherlands in their first game to get back into the game. But there should be no huge, the risk of sounding uber arrogant here, there should be no huge alarm bells. England know what they're facing.
Right. Shout out to Shaparenko for the wonderful diagonal ball to Yarmolenko before Zinchenko's goal. Of course, Forsberg had equalised shortly after that. A lot of people dubbing him the Scando Robbie Savage, a harsh but fair, on social media following that. He then hit the woodwork twice in the second half as Sweden came agonisingly close to taking the lead. But as you say, less and less happened of a footballing nature, and more of a footballer's falling over and being taken off and that kind of thing. And just when penalties were doing their looming, Zinchenko again with the cross for Artem Dovbyk. How much attention were you paying at this point, Adam?
Well, I tuned in sort of properly around 60 minutes, and it was there was just a lot of faffing. That's like, if there was one word to define from 60 minutes onwards, it was just faffing and subs and injuries. Obviously, some of the injuries were quite serious, so I have sympathy in that regard. Red card, very dramatic. I did enjoy that there was a real last gasp winner, because we obviously had penalty drama, and then we've had normal time late drama, but now we've had an extra time winner as well, right at the death. And it was great. The celebrations were amazing. Shevchenko was charging down the touchline, and then you have the coaches sort of arguing with each other a little bit. Then there was the VAR check. Not a massive fan of VAR, but I do enjoy those sort of high pressure moments where it looks like VAR may crush an entire nation, or awaken an entire nation at the same time. So it was, in the end, it was worth the investment that I made for about 60 minutes.
Right, okay. Well, we probably won't ask you for a view on Daniel's assertion that England have nothing to fear on Saturday from Ukraine.
No, well, I mean, from what I saw, it didn't look like they did. I mean, most of their players were sort of giving way as the game went on. I mean, it was like walking wounded by the end. I think it's hard to really work out, you know, how good that the level of this Ukrainian team is. I mean, Sweden, I think, are probably better suited to playing against better teams, in that they're able to sit back. They don't have to try and break down the opponent as much. They can sort of play on the counter and set plays a little bit more. Whereas, you know, they had to provide the impetus tonight. I think they would have been stodgier opponents for England, particularly, you know, when you see the way that Scotland stifled England. So I think it's probably the better of the two options between Sweden and Ukraine, but I wouldn't go as far as saying it's, you know, we're not in the semi-final, but I would be, you know, I'd think about resting one or two for the semi-final and final.
Really interesting. All right, well, the quarterfinal lineup is then Switzerland against Spain on Friday in St. Petersburg, Switzerland's first ever quarterfinals in the Euros. Italy will be taking on Belgium in Munich later that evening, and the winners of those two quarterfinals will be facing each other in the semi-final. Same deal for the two games on Saturday, Czech Republic against Denmark in Baku, and the winner of that will be up against either England or Ukraine in the semi-final. Crikey. Beyond England, which game of those four are you most looking forward to?
Well, Belgium-Italy feels like a semi-final in this tournament, in that I think they've been two of the four best teams in the tournament so far. I do think it's, there are various reasons, most of them completely valid and that I agree with, not to be hosting games in Baku in an international tournament at any time. But having got through the slog of the group stage, which is where teams have to travel that far, to then have a quarter-final there seems such a stupid misstep. I really feel for those teams who are not going to have fans being able to go 2,000 miles to Baku. That seems a ridiculous thing. And I also think the atmosphere in that stadium kind of kills the games as well. So, yeah, Belgium-Italy is a pretty obvious standout.
Mm. You've been following Belgium for The Athletic, Adam.
Yeah, and I mean, the big question mark for them ahead of that game is can Eden Hazard or Kevin De Bruyne get back? And at the moment, you know, they're facing a massively uphill task to get them back for that game. It looks more likely that they'd be available for a semi-final. I think it's a fascinating test for this Belgian team, because I think they were really pushed to their physical, actually, and psychological limits against Portugal on Sunday. They were losing, you know, they lost De Bruyne, they lost Hazard. They were playing probably in the toughest environment, you know, very, very hot night in Seville. They'd previously travelled to Russia for what was basically an away game in the group stage, then to Denmark, which was basically an away game. You know, they've got that old defence where Vermaelen was absolutely fantastic against Portugal, but you wonder, you know, can he do that twice in a week? Axel Witsel, 32, you know, he's 32 years old. He played 90 minutes against Finland, which was pretty much his first appearance, I think, apart from 20 minutes against Denmark, since January the 9th, and now he's done 90 minutes back-to-back. So they are really pushing themselves. And to do it without De Bruyne and Hazard would be monumental. It would also be a huge tick on the CV of Roberto Martinez if he was able to mastermind that victory against Italy, because I think there is a tendency with anything that Martinez does with Belgium that, you know, people say, oh, well, he's got great players, you know, he's got Hazard and De Bruyne and Lukaku, and it's always sort of in spite of him rather than because of him. I think if they were to beat Italy without those two star names on Friday, I think people would have to start giving Martinez far more respect, I think, for the job which he's done in Belgium, and actually the way he's considered in Belgium reflects that as well.
As producer Charlie has previously pointed out, he has history. He has previous in doing that to Mancini in a cup competition, FA Cup, Wembley, etc. and that. All right, not on that list of quarterfinalists are world champions France, and no one is more surprised about that than Julien Laurens. A day after getting, in social media speak, a Toblerone'd, we caught up with our favourite Frenchman in mourning. Jules.
Jimbo.
I'm so sorry, mon ami.
It's okay. You win some, you lose some.
Yeah. Just give us a little, we are world champions. Yeah, just.
We still are world champion for another 18 months.
There you
so
go.
I would not shut up, exactly. That's the one thing I can still, you know, hold on to be fair, right now. So,
okay.
You see?
How much did that game put you through the ringer? You know, from, say, Benzema's first goal and Pogba's magnificent strike to, you know, eventually Mbappe's penalty miss.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, I was not convinced at all by that back three to start with. And I was very skeptical before kickoff when, I mean, we had known from the day before we were briefed. So I had time, even I had 24 hours to think about it. Can this work? No, it can work. But what about this? No, it still cannot work. Okay, what about that? It still cannot work. That back three cannot work. Not with Pavard and Rabiot as wing backs. Not with Griezmann as a number 10. I never believed of Griezmann as a number 10 in that way. So I was very skeptical. And the first half went with the feeling I had. And I was really, really annoyed and really cross. And then the second half was so much better for the 25 minutes after the penalty, of course, because, again, Pavard. And we didn't have to wait for this tournament to know that Pavard was a dreadful footballer. Now we know for sure that no one can try to debate with me that Pavard is actually a good player. But that foul on Zuber was ridiculous. And after that, the 25 minutes that France put up after the penalty miss were fantastic. And then I thought, okay, this is it. It's us. We're going to play Spain in the next round.
No. I have to say, you didn't sound quite so sceptical when you joined us in Monday's show, and you talked about what France were going to do in the rest of the tournament after the Switzerland game. And I said, yeah, but are you not a bit worried by the way Austria have done well? Or certainly the Czechs knocking out the Dutch, and you know, maybe you should ne comptez pas vos poulets avant qu'il ne closent, as we say. And you said, well, the difference is the Netherlands don't have a good coach, unlike France. Are you still convinced about that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So we recorded that Sunday night when we knew that there was a possibility that they would play with the three at the back. It was not completely confirmed, but they had worked on training once. So we had that. I still didn't think that he would go ahead with the back three. And certainly I didn't think that they would still play that bad with the back three.
Right.
And I was certainly very arrogant, as always, in my predictions. I just didn't see this one coming. Switzerland are a good team. They have good players. Xhaka played well. Zuber played really well as well. Seferovic took his two goals in a great way. But this is a game that France invited the defeat to. And like Deschamps said after the game, the only good thing that he said pretty much all tournament was we didn't deserve to go further. And he's right. The way we played, the way we set up, the way we were complacent at 3-1 up, we didn't deserve to go through. And they deserved it far more than us. And I think they wanted even more than us because they never gave up. Whereas we gave up at 3-1 up, we thought it was won.
What's the reaction been like in France among the papers and the TV?
I think there's still a lot of like, did this really happen? Not just to be knocked out, because that can happen. It can happen to anyone, even the biggest favorite like us. But it's the way that game went, which was incredible for a neutral. But if you were French, it's hard to digest and hard to swallow, really, when you think about it being 3-1 up with 10 minutes to go.
Also, it's Switzerland.
Yeah, it is Switzerland. I mean, I think it's their golden generation, but the last time they reached a quarterfinal of any big tournament was in 1954. So golden generation or not, this is not what they do. And that's why, of course, you're right, it's even harder to take, because it was, you know, like one of my children said this morning, it's embarrassing to lose against them. And he's right. And in that manner, he's right. And it's even more cruel to lose on penalties and have Kylian Mbappe missing the last penalty, of course. And
right.
It was really hard. It was hard.
Although it kind of felt like that was in keeping with the kind of the storyline of the evening. I don't know, when he stepped up and it was down to his kick, or at least that was match point, it kind of felt like, yeah, it would be entirely in keeping if he misses this. There was a lot of talk here that the scenes after he failed to convert were a clear sign of a rift between him and some members of the team, the fact that the rest of his teammates didn't come to console him. Is that the case?
That's not true. That is not true.
I mean, not true?
I didn't watch the game. I saw Pogba, I saw Ding, I saw Sissoko coming towards him, and then he walked straight into the dressing room anyway. So it's not the feeling I had.
Mbappe did at least get Pele sliding into his DM saying, you know, you'll be back. It's all a step on the journey. I also like Le Monde, who essentially said that Mbappe has joined the likes of Platini, Zico, Baggio and Beckham in the list of great failed players in the penalty-taking exercise. So, you know, you can still be a great and blow the odd spot kick.
But I'll tell you what, the people who criticise him for missing that pen are people who know nothing about football. You cannot criticise Kylian Mbappe, the most important player in that team, to want to take the fifth penalty that can win you the tie and win you the game, could also lose you the game, as we saw. But this is what leaders do, regardless of his age or regardless of what his name is or if he had a good game or not, if he had a good tournament before. I would have been far more disappointed if he had not wanting to take that fifth penalty than him stepping up, going for it. It's not a great pen. It's not a bad pen either. It's a good save by Sommer. Good for him. But I don't understand how people can slag him off for missing that pen when, one, as we said, a lot of great players, and there's other few that we didn't name, including Leo Messi, in that list, and that you could blame it for him. That's not his fault if they lost, even if he missed that pen. And I just find it weird that, again, a lot of grown-up people who pretend that they know football are just ganging up on him because he missed that pen.
Okay. You did say, actually, on Sunday night in Monday's show, that if we once again took 45 minutes to get into a game, we could be in trouble. And so it proved. As for Deschamps, to have that squad, the World Championship winning squad, with the best striker in La Liga added, and then coming away with one win in four, it's not really a great look. But he did win you the World Cup, so I imagine his position is pretty untouchable for the moment.
Yes, he's safe. Jimbo, he's got a contract until December 2022 after the Qatar World Cup. Before the Euros, where the objective was semi-final, set by the French Federation. So they failed quite miserably. But the idea was even to already now extend his deal until after the Euros 2024. I think that might be delayed, certainly the extension, but he won't go anywhere. I like him in a way. I was so disappointed by what he did, or certainly what he didn't do during this tournament, because even if you take away this Switzerland, the first 45 minutes against Switzerland, there was never really the togetherness that we saw in 2018. I think Deschamps took a lot for granted, same with the players. There was not real direction. There was certainly no identity in what they did. Not even the identity that we saw in 2018, which was not always pretty, but at least you knew exactly what they would do, how they would do it. But this time that was not even there. But on the other hand, I kind of like him. And I think that in him, he's such a stubborn competitor that I would want to believe that he's going to sit down and think, okay, I messed it up completely. Because he did. I mean, there was an answer he gave on French television the other day where he almost seemed to realize that some teams in this competition were setting up differently, whether they had the ball or not. And I'm like, dude, what do you mean? You didn't know that you could have a formation when you have the ball to do stuff with the ball and use the best quality of your players with that formation with the ball and then change it when you don't have the ball and you need to recover the ball and get the ball back and it's a different formation because you do different things. But he seemed to actually find out. And I'm like, so I don't know what happened to him. I really don't know. I would want to believe that he's going to bounce back and we want to do better and change a few things and go more towards what we saw in 2018 than what we saw in 2021. But only time will tell. But I was so disappointed.
Julien Laurent. And by the way, the team may have been united even in that defeat against Switzerland, but at least according to Radio Monte Carlo Sport, some of their families off the field are anything but. A great story on RMC Sport of their mothers going at it in the stands during and after the Switzerland game. Principally Véronique Rabiot, who, after the third goal for Switzerland, the equaliser, apparently asked Pogba's people how he could lose the ball like that. And then at the full-time whistle, had a go at Kylian Mbappe's father, telling him to tell his son not to be so arrogant. Adam.
Yeah, so, I mean, in the interest of balance and in defence of Véronique Rabiot, who apparently she doesn't really appear to need much defending from other people, actually, the Paul Pogba clan were reported as well to maybe have actually started the situation earlier in the game when they reacted negatively to Rabiot conceding the ball. And security officers apparently had to tell those close to Paul Pogba to calm down. So there may be two sides to Véronique Rabiot and La Famille de Pogba warming up and then boiling over as the game went on.
My hope is that this ends in a kind of Rebecca Vardy-style investigation where it turns out Véronique does the match ratings for L'Équipe. That would be the ultimate, I think.
Magnificent. She might well be these days because she's no longer her son's agent after he famously fired her after a prospective move from Paris Saint-Germain to Barcelona fell through in 2019. So an interesting family. Anyway, very shortly, we'll be looking back on a classic 30th of June from a Euro of yesteryear. First, though, let's get some odds from Paddy Power. And for that, it's over to producer Ben.
Thank you very much, Jimbo. I'm on the line with Jason Murphy from Paddy Power again. Jason, the quarterfinals lineup is secure. We're taking a couple of rest days, so let's look ahead to Friday night games. First up, it's Switzerland versus Spain. Two amazing last 16 ties. Can they repeat it? Will there be four or more goals when they meet?
Yeah, let's hope they do. We should all be recovered by now for when this game kicks off. For four or more goals, it's 13-5 for it to happen. In terms of the match prices, Spain to qualify is 2-7. Might sound a little bit short, and it's the same price that went off against Croatia. But obviously now, Luis Enrique knows his best front three. Sarabia, what a surprise him being in the squad, but he's definitely in the front three now with Torres and Morata. He knows his midfield three. But what's he going to do with those centre-backs? And that's the concern for this game, because if you look at what Seferovic did to a very weak centre-back pairing in the French game, we're going to see likewise whether it's Torres, whether it's Garcia at the back line in Spain. And that means that for this particular bet, if you're going with four more goals, Switzerland will definitely play their part in it and could chip in with a few. But look, if it's anything as good as Monday, then we're in for a real treat. And like I say, Spain probably just a little bit short based on what we've seen from Switzerland.
Okay, Italy v Belgium also taking place that night. Probably won't be quite as entertaining. And Belgium not looking in the best shape after coming through Portugal. Can you give us some numbers on this one, please?
Yeah, we're waiting on team news the same as everyone else. We're waiting to see on Kevin De Bruyne what the situation is. Eden Hazard came off holding his leg. At the moment, Italy to qualify is 8-13. And if those two players aren't on the pitch, that price seems right to me. But if they're declared fit and on the pitch, then Italy would be too short if they hold that price. The player I'd be looking to, regardless of whether Hazard and De Bruyne are on the pitch, is Lukaku. He's 9-2 to score the first goal. The markets are essentially saying that when Belgium score a goal, it's Lukaku scores them 38% of the time. That's a massive contribution, but you can see it that he does it. People would have had concerns when he left the Premier League that maybe he was stepping down a level in Serie A, out of sight, out of mind. But people that are narrow tunnel vision just watching Premier League, they're seeing just how good Lukaku is now. He's just turned 28. He's in his peak. Like I said, 9-2 for the first goal here. But Italy at 8-13, if there's no De Bruyne or the older Hazard, that price is probably about right. But if they are fit, then Italy going off 8-13 would be a little bit short. But listen, you don't always have to have a bet in the game. I've watched enough of Burnley against Palace. I've watched it 40 times, I feel like, in the last 9 months. We got some payback Monday. Let's hope we get some payback with these two quarterfinal games, because this is the best of football that you'll ever get.
The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power. Find a bookie who loves you right back as much as Gareth loves right backs. Place a 4+-fold bet builder on any football match and get money back as a free bet if one leg lets you down. Check paddypower.com for more details. £10 max free bet. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Finally then, for today's historic edition of Totally at the Euros, it's a bit of on this day, this day being the 30th of June, and the year in question being 1996. Crikey. And the venue was Wembley. And it was a happier occasion that time for Germany, who achieved their last European Championship success. It was against the Czech Republic, and it featured the very first golden goal in the history of major international football from substitute Oliver Bierhoff.
Bierhoff kann sich durchsetzen, Kuba! Und Deutschland ist Europameister! Und wieder war es Oliver Bierhoff durch das erste golden goal.
They think it's Oliver. Well, it is now, as the commentator surely should have said. Do you remember that game, Daniel?
I was 10 years old, and I...
Yes.
Something that I didn't do very often at that age, which was blankly refuse to watch it as a stand at England losing to Germany on penalties, which I've not quite taken that sort of vitriolic stance in slightly later life. But yeah, I was having absolutely none of it. The tournament was finished as far as I was concerned.
What depressing age were you at the time, Adam?
This was June, so two and a bit.
Okay, that's enough.
I absorbed it all from my cult.
Okay. Well, I was, you know, a fully grown man by this point, remarkably, and but also I was a bit of a fan of Oliver Bierhoff, who at the time wasn't a big name, but you know, subsequently went on to be one. He was a bit of a journeyman striker in Italy. He'd been playing for Ascoli in the second division, where he wasn't very successful. Things used to happen to him, like he would pull up at the traffic lights and fans would recognise him and slap him for not scoring more goals. But anyway, after that, he made a move to Udinese, who were always on the hunt for kind of unknown talent, and blossomed into this incredible goal-scoring machine after the Euros. This is 97-98. He got 27 goals in 34 matches in Serie A as Udinese tore it up and went all the way to a UEFA Cup berth. Anyway.
That's why he became my favourite striker when I was 3 years old, Oliver Bierhoff.
Is that right?
Yes. It was the period at Udinese that won me over. I was very disappointed with him as an 18-month-old at Ascoli. Slapping about, but by 3 hours fully into it.
Okay, well, I see you're joking with me. There you go. Bertie Vogt, by the way, that day, this day in 1996, at Wembley, became the only person to date to win the Euros as both a player and then as a manager. A feat that, of course, Didier Deschamps could have matched this year had things worked out better. Oliver Bierhoff is national team director at the DFB. He's the man who will now be overseeing the handover from Jogi Löw to, of course, Hansi Flick. Very good. That brings us to the end of today's Totally at the Euros. Tomorrow there won't be one because there are no matches, but we will be back, well, for us on Friday night, straight after those two quarterfinals, and that show should be with you early Saturday morning. So I do hope you join us for that. Many thanks, listener, for being with us today. And many thanks to you as well, Adam and Daniel, and to Rafa earlier on. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Keep up to date with everything Totally at The Totally Show on Twitter and find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.